Hello from Holden Village. Today is June 15th, 1998. And in the fireside room this evening, Paul Olson presents a session called Good Reading, The Courage to Be Unconventional. And this is OLP 98-4.
And the title of this session is Good Courage, The Courage to Be Unconventional, a look at some extremist or radical themes in literature. And my name is Paul Olson. Has anybody been to the Bible study at all since you've gotten here? One of the things that at least every Bible study teacher approaches it differently, but one of the things that Esther Mann is doing is looking very closely at short passages, and this morning we looked at just several verses, and that's a really worthwhile thing to do, as you all know. But it's also worthwhile to kind of step back from all of that and try to ask some really big questions about themes that run through all of the stories, and so I'm going to do that with you to start out this whole discussion and representation from what some people call secular literature. I don't call it that. What are some, if we step back and just ask the question, what are some major themes that run through the Old and the New Testaments? Now I'm going to record these for you.
The problem of good and evil?
Yeah, for sure. The war of good. I guess your word is better. The problem of good and evil. And that's what Milton's Paradise Lost is about. That's what Faulkner's Song of the Fury is about. That's what Sophie's Choice by William Styron is about. Lots of great literature picks up on that too. Others?
Life, death, life cycle.
The life cycle. The life, death, life. I better make it clear. Good.
Kind of going around the first, isn't it fall and redemption?
Sure. Yeah. Redemption. And you said fall and redemption. Others. It's an interesting thing to do, to look at these big themes, and then when you go back and look at specifically focus on some brief passages and think about them in these grander theme connections, it brings a different context to that specific excerpt that you're looking at.
About God leading his people.
Sure. God leads God's people. In God's intervention, it's about that, of course. I'm thinking of a line in the American novel Sophie's Choice, where at the end of the book they say, "Tell me, at Auschwitz, where was God?" And the answer is, "Tell me, where was man?" The notion of God's intervention, or failure to intervene in things like the grand evils of the world, the Holocaust and slavery and so on. Others.
Just to go with that, just persistent faith or enduring
sure.
belief, and despite all odds or all awful things happening, people's faith enduring.
Nice word. Persistent faith. I'm going to add some for you just to, again, to give a context for some of this that we're going about here, too. I think one of the things that happens in the Old and New Testament a lot is the notion of somehow stripping away what we have and what we are to find something else. In academia, they might call it existential stripping. In the real world, we might just call it being born again. So I'm just going to, I'll put it that way, this notion of rebirth, but not in the life-death sense, but in the rebirth of one's self and one's sense of the self, and is also the self in relationship to God, too. And I can't read that word. But are there others? We talked about this in another session earlier last week, about the notion of the loss of innocence, and this the important loss of innocence that then contributes to a rise in consciousness. And in that particular instance, we looked at the Old Testament story of the creation. and the fall, that this is a loss of innocence that's important, and as John Milton calls it, the fortunate fall. So one of the themes that runs through there is the loss of innocence, and and I'm going to add that the rise to consciousness. That's a New and Old Testament thing too. How about another one, and the last one to just throw out and put in this big scheme of things, the notion of wilderness. It's pretty interesting that the wilderness experience is resisted by everybody, or very profound things happen in that wilderness experience. The Hebrews, and if you're a literature student at all, you pay attention to these kind of things. You know, if the writer says something a few times, you know, repeats it, you think, that's a clue. I should be asking something about that. And the Hebrew people say three times to Moses, after all these spectacular miracles, hey, Moses, we'd be better off back there in the flesh pots of Egypt, you know, in slavery, than we are here wandering in the wilderness. And now they've had manna, and they've had bread, and they've had a fire, and they've had a cloud, and they've had the sea open up. They've had incredible signs that none of us get to have. And they'd still rather be back there in slavery, because the wilderness is a tough experience. And the wilderness isn't just trees and rocks and rivers, and it's a wilderness experience of the mind. And then you take that concept of the resistance to wilderness and what happens in the wilderness up to the New Testament and look at Jesus' experience. Note that that experience comes before he begins his mission. Note that at the end of that experience, what's the most profound thing that happens to him? Satan comes, takes him up on the hill, and says, I got three ideas for you. And Jesus says no to all of them. I mean, his wilderness experience involves some pretty incredible heavy things, some temptations that, yeah, you know, it would be pretty nice if everybody knew I was God. You know, then I wouldn't have all this hassle. I could, you know, jump off the cliff, right? Make some spectacular miracles. Well, so I'm going to add that one up here too. What does this have to do with courage to be unconventional? That's another major theme, I think, that runs through many of the books of the Bible, and if we step back from the Old and New Testament, we see that. And without reading them, I didn't even bring a Bible just to kind of expedite us into different kinds of literature. I just looked in the book of Matthew for things that lead us to have good courage to be unconventional in the way we live. And here's, you know them all. Matthew 5 is about, the Old Testament says, or the scriptures say, you shall not kill. And what does Jesus say? I say, it's an incredible statement. Anybody that's been angry with his brother or sister is just as guilty as someone who's killed. Well, it sort of takes care of all of us, doesn't it? Matthew 5 later. Love your enemies. And Jesus points out, he's even the tax collector. Well, we all love those people who love us. That's pretty easy. Jesus says, love your enemies. Matthew 6. Don't lay up treasures for the moths and for rust. Is there anybody here that doesn't collect something that is susceptible to moths and rust? And he's telling us, you know, don't do it. That's pretty unconventional. We keep going. Matthew 7, judge not. We know the story of the log in your own eye while you're complaining about the speck in somebody else's. Matthew 10, lose your life to find it. Love me more than mother or father. That is an absolutely impossible thing for us, isn't it, to even imagine that? But that's pretty unconventional. Save your life to lose it, Matthew 16. Lose your life and find it. Forgive 70 times 7, Matthew 18. The one I have the most trouble with, in Matthew 19, 16th verse. Sell what you possess and give it to the poor. I've read that a million times, a lot of times, and I say, even my boat? What's going on? What kind of unconventional thinking are we asked, unconventional living are we asked to do? What would you say about all of that? I mean, how many people do that? Do any of that?
Well, I don't want to get you off track from where you're headed, but I'm reminded of, at this time, of a cartoon I saw once. That this gentleman was out wading in the river, smoking a big cigar, and a board comes floating down the river, And on the board, when it gets to him, he sees it says no smoking. So he puts the cigar out. And don't we have to look at some of this in context with our present time?
Sure. So what does that mean then? I ask, in my present time, in my present context, I say, even my boat? I mean, my boat is a symbol for family times. We've skied in the Mississippi River hours and hours and hours, and I've taken it camping, and it's a neat thing. I don't want to part with that. I'm not going to give it to you. You might be poor, but you're not getting it. I mean, so, but what is there anything else going? That's why I put all these big themes up here, too. A thematic context and a specific command, are there two different things? So what's the theme of being unconventional about? Does it mean that when this sign comes down the river, I'm going to put my cigarette out? Does it mean I really do have to sell my boat? And we got a lot of nice clothes sitting right here in this group. Got to get rid of them. How many people have cars? I mean, we don't have to go any further. We don't do it. So in this modern context, what does it mean then? One thing it means is that we've all decided we're going to interpret the Bible any way we want to. And we're going to pick up this verse, and you know, there are verses in there that say you can't mix linens and wools together, and who pays attention to that? And you know, so some things we take literally, others we don't, and that's good reading, I think. But my bigger question then is, how do we react to big themes that run through the book, the books? And I'll give you a suggestion, and then we'll go to some of this other literature. I think that one of the things that's really helpful as we look at the Bible, one, yes, it's a great thing to look specifically as we have done in some of our Bible studies here at Holden. That's a great thing, and that enriches these bigger themes, and they make more sense. Another thing that's helpful about stepping back and kind of getting a sense of the themes is, what does it say about my personal vision of how I'm going to live my life? And can I live with the vision that Jesus asks and still keep my boat? Now that might be one huge big rationalization, and we'll look at that. But let's see what some of the great thinkers and writers of our time say about, you know, the courage to be unconventional and the courage to look at the big themes that run in our lives as well in our literature. And I'll start it with a story that I like to tell about my own teaching experience, but as soon as I get into it, you realize that this really didn't happen. I had a student once who was flunking out of, I teach at Ox State College in Rock Island, Illinois, and this kid was flunking out. And I'm what I'd call a student advocate kind of teacher, not an adversary, and so I'm going to help this guy. And I said, okay, if you can pass this course, you're going to stay in school, right? Right. Okay, I'm going to give you the test ahead of time, and here's the test. There are three questions. And the first one is, you go home overnight, think about this, come back tomorrow, take the test, and you're home free. The first question is, how many days in the week begin with T? Okay, you know, I'm on this kid's side, right? Second question is, how many seconds are there in a week? In a year, how many seconds in a year? And you go home, think about that. And the last one is, how many D's in Dixie? Obviously, I want this kid to pass. I'm going to give him an A if he can get this test done. He comes back the next day and says, I'm ready to go. I can take the test. I'm ready. Okay, how many days in the week begin with T? He says, four. I want him to pass. I said, four. How do you get four? Tuesday, Thursday, today, and tomorrow. He's thought about it a little differently, a little bit, we might say, unconventionally. Okay, great, I'll give you credit for that. How many seconds are there in a year? What are you expecting? You expect this kid to multiply, you know, 60 times 60 times 24 and so on. Seconds, and he says, 12. I'm sinking. My heart is, he's not going to make it. How do you get 12? January 2nd, February 2nd, March 2nd, April 2nd. Okay. I'll give you credit for that. You're doing fine. The last one is, and I know he's going to come home free, this one, how many D's in Dixie? And we're all looking for this, right? He said, I couldn't get that one. So, Bill, I can help you. What do you mean you couldn't get it? He said, I stayed up all night. I thought about that. I went through it in my mind. And I can be close, but I can't. It's somewhere between 54 and 56. What? How do you get that? Well, the point of the whole thing, of course, is that this kid thinks in a completely different paradigm than any of us expected him to think, of course. Well, I think that our great writers that we pay attention to do that too. And one of the reasons to read, one of the reasons to read that I believe is to really enhance our faith and to read what, I had it up here before and I erased it. Does spiritual literature, is it unequal to secular literature? And I had a great discussion with somebody in our church once about that what I taught was secular literature, and I said, I don't think so. I think that all great literature is spiritual. Well, never mind that argument, except to let you decide if you care about that argument now. As we listen to James Baldwin, this book, by the way, is in the bookstore, and Baldwin is the great African-American essayist and novelist and playwright of our century. I mean, he's dead now, but he's current. If anybody here went to Luther, he spoke at Luther. That's probably been 10, 12 years ago now. But here's James Baldwin in The Fire Next Time, talking about the essays about being black in America, and one dimension of being black in America is persecution from the church. And this is our church. It is not too much to say that whoever wishes to become a truly moral human being, and let us not ask whether or not this is possible, I think we must believe that it is possible, anyone that wants to become a truly moral human being must first divorce herself or himself from all the prohibitions, crimes, and hypocrisies of the Christian church. If the concept of God has any validity or any use, it can only be to make us larger, freer, and more loving. That's a pretty radical statement. And as we think about what, if we read the whole book and get an understanding of how Baldwin has experienced the church and its history sure bears it out in many, now I'm talking about the institutional church, and we'll get a chance to discuss it. The church is probably the most proactive pro-slavery institution in America in the 19th century. And Baldwin is aware of that. The church has not made us larger, freer, and more loving. It's made us smaller and more restricted. And in fact, less loving. We've excluded people, and we know how that is manifest in today's world too. Well, that's just one start on this. The Color Purple by Alice Walker. Have anybody read this? It's worth a look, I think. It's not great theology. It might not even be a great novel, but it's a very, very good one, and it's a very important one. And the point I would raise about this, that in this story of a young woman that starts out at 14, growing up, is raped by a man that she thinks is her father, and then her children are taken away from her, and then she's abused physically and emotionally and spiritually by her husband, who she is just given to, you know, for a cow. She has a pretty miserable life for the first part of her existence, and then she meets some other people in her life and things change. But my point, and I'm just kind of summarizing very vaguely and abstractly this novel, is that the only relationships that work in this novel are the unconventional ones. There are two women and a man raising a family, and there's great love there. There's great love between two women that is both physical and spiritual. There's great love in a family that's where there are two men and one woman, and they raise kids and create love. Then the conventional marriages don't work. They're awful. They're abusive. They're selfish, and they're fundamentally immoral. To read something from one of the people who talks in this about God and how God can work in their relationship, I'm skipping through some parts, and this is one woman speaking to another. I have never ever found God in church. Never did. I just found a bunch of folks hoping for him to show. Any God I ever felt in church, I brought in with me. And I think all the other folks did too. They come to church to share God, not find God. Here's the thing I believe. God is inside you and inside everybody else. You come into the world with God, but only them that search for it inside find it. What does Jesus say about the kingdom of God? It's pretty unconventional, but what the writer, I think, is after us, one of the many things is after us to do, is to search for this kingdom of God differently than we have been. most of us do come to church hoping to find God. We can find all kinds of exceptions to this, of course. But we see the general rule of this, and sometimes it just, I'll back up. You come into the world with God, but only them that search for it inside find it. And sometimes it just manifests, it is her pronoun for God. Sometimes it just manifests itself even if you're not looking or don't know what you're looking for. Trouble do it for most folks, I think. Sorrow. I think it pisses God off if you walk by the color purple in a field somewhere and don't notice it. We all walk past. I mean, that's unconventional, isn't it, too, to stop and, you know, smell the roses kind of thing, but we had a little more literary statement with it. And then this statement that by most critics is so often taken as a statement about, as under womanist or feminist criticism, that says this is about males, and it's not. I'll take on all those critics now, and say this is about humankind. And listen to what the speaker says. Man, and I'm suggesting that it means all of us, man corrupt everything, say Shug. He on your box of grits in your head and all over the radio. He try to make you think he everywhere, but he ain't. Soon as you think he everywhere, you think he God, but he ain't. Whenever you try to pray and man plop himself on the other end of it, tell him to get lost. Conjure up the real God. Everybody follow that? Humans corrupt everything. They're on your box of grits in your head and all over the radio, and they try to make you think he everywhere. As soon as you think he everywhere, you think he God. But he ain't. Put that in your own words once, or if you can, identify with some kind of experience that we have, whether it's yours personally or just something you recognize culturally, about this thing is everywhere that we think is God. What do we idolize?
Things.
And can you be really specific? It's a great answer. We do idolize things, our boats, our water skis.
Possessions.
Okay, lots of our possessions, our
your
homes.
Boat.
What?
My car.
Sure, our car, my boat, good. Are there other things that aren't so easy to see?
Sometimes I wonder if we idolize some of our relationships.
Sure. Love me more than your mother. Wow, that's unconventional.
I think we idolize our country.
We idolize our country. At the expense of?
The world.
What do we have, 10% of the world's population? What kind of resources do we use? What else do we idolize? Some things that are harder to see. Do we idolize good things? And by idolize, I mean, let them, we think that's God, that's our goal. Listen to Shug speak. He tried to make you think he's everywhere. As soon as you think he's everywhere, you think he's God. This humankind, these things that... Not only do we have things that we idolize, but do we idolize ideas?
Idolize people.
We idolize people.
Institutions.
We idolize institutions. We can even idolize the church. I'm having a session with you, whoever wants to come, on Jonah in a couple days. And one of the things that Jonah idolizes, I think, is his concept of God. He doesn't want God to do what God wants to do. And I'll be damned if I'm going to follow you if you're going to be that way, God. Well, God has the last say in that whole story. Jonah has not idolized God. Jonah is not this faithful. I mean, that's what we'll have to look at and see. Is he a faithful follower, an obedient servant once he gets shaped up? Or is he really reluctant to give up his notion of God? My God is not going to forgive those rotten Assyrians. I mean, he's told to go to Nineveh. Not going to do it. Well, we have more fun. Get real radical with you. Here's an African-American poet, Donnell Lee, and you're all old enough to know the Vietnam War, and I'll read this poem as I've heard Donnell, you know it, even though you weren't there, you know it. This is poetry. Anybody in here, an English major, an English teacher, or ever looked at anybody that's defined poetry, this takes care of that definition right now. This is how it It's a stage poem, and this is how Don L. Lee himself reads it. Dee 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 wee 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 nig 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 kick 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 rip 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 bum 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 death to click, 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 death to death to all 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 death to all 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 the Paris Peace Talks, 1968. Poetry? I mean, Samuel Johnson isn't going to call that poetry. William Wordsworth isn't going to call that poetry. I mean, the guys that give the definitions. What does that rhyme with, right? So, in this unconventional, the creation of the thing itself is unconventional. And then what it says, the Paris Peace Talks, what's happened to us who have experienced that poem? And I tell all my students this, literary criticism starts from your guts. So don't worry about what you're thinking right now. What do you feel? You hear this junk. Dee dee dee, twig, twig, all that to all. What are you thinking?
Babble.
And? Anybody know what went on in 1968 in the Paris Peace Talks? 6 months.
For the rectangle versus
They debated the shape of the table. And I don't have the statistics, I should, since I look at this poem every now and then. How many people died in 6 months? Well, they're debating the shape of the table. Babble. Great. What else? Just what, again, I'm looking for, don't think I'm looking for some kind of smart academic intellectual answer. In your guts, when you hear this junk read, what do you feel? Stop! Or, I mean, I don't care what it is. What is it you honestly feel?
Get a different job.
Me?
No, the writer.
Oh, the writer, yeah, get a different job. You're not a poet, it's obvious.
There's so factions going back and forth, arguing, and
you felt that.
Yeah, because you're different tones and that, just so, kind of one yeah. person and then.
Yeah, that's interesting. Good. Good.
It seems to me a lot of noise and no substance.
A lot of noise and no substance. Well. Connect back, that's a great sentence, and connect back to these big themes, not anyone's in specifically, but the notion of a theme, and what's happened to our vision with this? Do we see Vietnam differently in 1968? Or do we see those peace talks in 1968 any differently after hearing this babble than we did before? I remember in my unconscious youth looking at the newspaper saying, oh, Vietnam, boy, I'm glad I'm not going to get drafted. I got a deferment. I mean, I had no vision. This poem way back then started me. I mean, to move slowly toward wake up, Olson. Poets, and fiction writers too, but lump them all in the word, poets help create in us a new vision. I would contend, it enriches for me the New Testament, anything I pick up, especially in the Gospels, that Jesus, first of all, in his humanity, was a poet. And think about the images he used, think how he talks to us. He doesn't talk very often, and maybe you guys are better Bible scholars than I am, he doesn't very often use reason. We're talking about lilies and sparrows and forgiving people who go away and, you know, and have no right to come back to their house, but they get to. And we're talking, I mean, he's, the other things that I read earlier on, he's so unconventional. He doesn't appeal to our reason, but his poetry speaks to our, I think, our human vision. Here's how that's manifest by this wonderful writer, Toni Morrison. Anybody read Song of Solomon? Beloved, her new book, Paradise. I'm in the middle of that right now, and I have to say I'm having trouble with it. I started out great. Boy, this is good, and then I got lost. Song of Solomon is, in a phrase, is a story. My favorite American literary character is in this book. Her name is Pilate Dead. And Pilate Dead has, remember this is fiction, she has no navel. And somehow, that's her flaw in life, but it's not, as the writer says, not grotesque enough to put her in a circus or, is, you know, or any on display at all. So she just kind of gets ostracized, but can never, you know, she doesn't have three arms or something that can she can show to people. And so this flaw has her ostracized. And she has one chance to have a relationship in her life, and she does, I mean, a sexual relationship, and by that relationship she has a daughter. But the guy wakes up in the morning and looks at her and says, "My God, what are you, some kind of mermaid?" And he runs off. And my point in telling you that part of the story is that she has no opportunity to have any intimate relationships with anybody from now on. And she's also ostracized by her community because she is so strange. She has a brother who has a whole sense of values that is American, that is, like Baldwin would suggest, is a typical American culture. And the three main characters I'm going to just read from, or read about now, are a guy named Macon Dead, that is Pilot Dead's brother, and Macon Dead has a son named Milkman. And those three characters are in this three different episodes I'm going to read for you. Milkman is growing up, he's ready to take over the business, and his father, Macon Dead, says to him, "Boy, you've got better things to do with your time than hang out at Pilot's. Besides, it's time you started learning how to work. You start Monday. After school, come to my office. Work a couple of hours there and learn what's real." Pilot, whom Milkman, the first time he met her, he loved her. He said, I mean, she is really weird, and she shaves her head, and she wears combat boots, and she picks orange peels out of her fingernails, and eats when she wants to, and she's really very unconventional. And he doesn't want his son hanging out with her. Pilot can't teach you a thing you can use in this world. Maybe the next, but not this one. Let me tell you right now the one important thing you'll ever need to know. Own things. And let the things you own other things. And then you'll own yourself and other people too. And starting Monday, I'm going to teach you how. It's clear what his values are, right? Well, Pilot, her history is told to us. And then finally, Pilot began to take offense. Although she was hampered by huge ignorances, but not in any way unintelligent, when she realized what her situation in the world was and would probably always be, she threw away every assumption she had learned and began at zero. This is rebirth. This is the movement from, what phrase do we have up there? A fall. It's sell all you have. It's throw away every assumption she had learned and begin at zero. And the assumptions in American culture for her brother are own things. This is the value. This is his idolatry. She threw away every assumption she had learned and began at zero. First off, she cut her hair. That was one thing she didn't want to have to think about anymore. Then she tackled the problem of trying to decide how she wanted to live and what was valuable to her. When am I happy and when am I sad? And what is the difference? What do I need to know to stay alive? What is true in the world? She threw away every assumption she had. At the end of this book, and I don't think it spoils it for you, Pilot, like all people with that kind of vision, is murdered. She dies in the arms of her nephew, Milkman, who, it's clear by now, he loves her. And it's clear by now he has made this long journey toward her values and away from his father's values. He's lost everything he had. He's lost his car. He's lost his billfold. He's lost his briefcase. And he is with Pilot, and somebody cracks a rifle and it hits her. She stood up then. And it seemed to Milkman that he heard the shot after she fell. He dropped to his knees and cradled her lolling head in the crook of his arm, barking at her, "Are you hurt? You hurt, Pilot?" She laughed softly, and he knew right away that she was reminded of the day he first met her and said the most stupid thing there was to say. The twilight had thickened, and all around them it was getting dark. Milkman moved his hand over her chest and stomach, trying to find the place where she might be hit. "Pilot, you okay?" He couldn't make out her eyes. His hand under her head was sweating like a fountain. Pilot, she sighed. Watch Reba, it's her daughter. Watch Reba for me. And then, I wish I'd have known more people. I would have loved them all. If I'd have known more, I would have loved more. I guess I'd ask you now, what price is paid to live with unconventional values? And think of anything you want to in these stories so far, or in what you've experienced or what you see in American culture.
Ostracism.
The price of ostracism. Good.
Yeah, I think you're misunderstood, and so it's a lonely road. It's not even because of the fact it's unconventional. So therefore, there's nobody else, not me, on that same path.
Yeah. Good. We have a woman in this in the village now, who was at one time part of an interracial marriage. Ask her about the price she paid, and that he paid. Others. I have an image. I don't do it. I don't have enough guts to be this unconventional. But I'm really against the Chemlon stuff. You know, they come along, they spray in your yard. So I don't do it. And I pat myself on the back for that. And as I sit on my butt, and I got a big lawn too, and I pull out the dandelions and the weeds and this charlie grass, and I just pull it off my hands and I throw it away and I haul it off. And I do that a couple times a summer, and I'm real proud of that. And then I think, that's not being unconventional. Because I still value the thing that everybody else values, which is the green lawn. And if I were really unconventional, I would learn to love dandelions. But who's going to pay that price? Paul, mow your lawn, for crying out loud. I don't want your dandelions drifting down to my yard and, you know, polluting my yard, making it all full of this sea stuff. I'm not going to do it. And I'm not going to fight the neighbors on that. Plus, I really like a big green lawn. And my point is, I'm pretty conventional. And it's so hard not to be. And then we think of those commands that are that Jesus gives us, you know, sell all you have, love your enemies, forgive 70 times 7. We had a great Bible study with Martin Wells a couple of days ago, and he read the story of David and Bathsheba and asked, anybody have any comments? And I said, yeah, what I'm feeling is I got this anger, and David is such a jerk. How do I get past that? And I don't have any mercy for David. I don't want God to forgive him. I just like Jonah. Don't forgive that sucker. Put him out, let him go do Uriah's thing. And stick him out in front. Then my point is only, I'm not real eager to forgive David once, let alone 70 times 7. Where do we all fit in there? One of my points isn't that it isn't just courage that causes unconventional thinking and unconventional living. It's also vision and a whole stripping away of how can I, to be concrete, how can I get myself to not like this nice green lawn? What does it take? That's what I meant by what price do we pay?
We were talking about one of the prices you pay is being ostracized. And I'm thinking, if you get ostracized already, it makes it easier. It sort of catapults you on it anyway. In other words, sometimes that comes first, and I think that was what you were reading.
Sure, yes.
You get ostracized for some reason, and then you reject those values because that's part of how you got ostracized.
Yeah, very good.
You know, somehow... For you know, there could be a lot of different scenarios for that. Something that you didn't ask for.
Yeah, good. Yeah, you'd enjoy Richard Wright's American Hunger, or now it says it's published the second half of the new publication of Black Boy, in which Wright says, if I were in charge of the country, the people I would seek out are not those who murder and steal, for by their very acts they have defined themselves within the values of the country. They steal the stuff that we want. They murder people to keep, you know, them from taking the stuff that I want. He said, I would ferret out, I'm quoting him now, I would ferret out those who do nothing and have given up on the prizes of society. or what he calls America's lust for trash. They're already ostracized. They've given up, and they're the dangerous ones. And the people who killed Jesus knew that too, didn't they? Jesus, this guy is dangerous. I mean, he doesn't want, you know, he doesn't want to eat. He's been out there for 40 days and he's supposed to be hungry. He doesn't want to. This guy is too weird. Well, here's one that's even a little heavier, I think, academic or intellectually, but it's a concept that you'll sure understand, I'm sure. Parlagraphus, the guy who wrote the book Barabbas, which is the one to read in his works if you're interested in that, and our library has that too. Barabbas is an imaginative account of what it must have been like to be the guy that Jesus died for. And Barabbas is puzzled by that throughout his journey. But in this book called The Death of Azarus, when this main character finally dies, he makes this statement about God. And he's been pretty disgusted with institutionalized God, and because he's fought it, that's part of why it's part of why he isn't able to die. And he finally releases this concept given to him by others of God, and he comes to his own conclusion, and here's what he says. Beyond the gods, beyond all that falsifies and coarsens the world of holiness, beyond all the lies and distortion, all twisted divinities and all the abortions of human imagination, there must be something stupendous. Beyond all the sacred clutter, the holy thing itself must exist. That I believe, of that I am certain. Yes, God, and he means the God that he has been taught to follow, and he's got a small g. Yes, God is what divides us from the divine, hinders us, in fact. Can we idolize God? Was a question that, you know, indirectly came up earlier. Yes, God is what divides us from the divine, hinders us from drinking at the spring of the divine itself. I would gladly lie down at that spring to drink from it, to quench my thirst, my burning thirst, for what I almost cannot conceive of, but which I know exists. It's an ultimate kind of faith, and it still is a pretty radical, unconventional look at. He's not going to idolize the God that's been handed to him. Any responses to that? Do churches do that? Does our church collectively, the institutional church, does your church?
I think all religions do.
All religions. Dostoevsky says, put away your gods or I'll come and give you, put away your gods and take up ours or I'll kill you. And the brothers come out. How many different denominations? Anybody know that? Are there in the United States? Obviously, it's because they're all wrong, right? And we're right. And we will fight for that. And we, okay. Anything on a national, that's easier to talk about perhaps, on a national level where the church itself has idolized its concept? Well, Lagerfeld asks it, and it's provocative, and it's not inappropriate at Holden to leave the question. Not everything is so radical. And I've got another example. I have two more examples that I can quickly, and you know, let's respond to both of them, because they're very different. One is another poem by one of those so-called black revolutionary poets of the 60s. And this is pretty rough language, but this is the 60s, and you'll like it. This is called A Poem to Compliment Other Poems. Change, like if you were to match, I would light you into something beautiful. Change, change, change for the better into a real, real together thing. Change from a make-believe nothing on cornmeal and water. Change, change from the last drop to the first. Maxwell House did. Change. Change was a programmer for IBM, thought him was a brown computer. Change. This is a black poet, by the way. Colored to something written on southern outhouses. Change, Greyhound did. I mean, they got restrooms on buses. Change, 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 nigger. Saw a nigger hippie, him wanted to be different. Changed. Saw a nigger liberal, him wanted to be different. Changed. Saw a nigger conservative, him wanted to be different. Changed. Niggers, don't you know that niggers are different? Change. A double change. Nigger wanted a 00 in front of his name, a license to kill. 007. Niggers are licensed to be killed. Change. A negro, something. I say change into a real black, righteous aim. Like, I don't play the saxophone, but that don't mean I don't dig train. Change, here you coming, but your steps are too loud. Change, even a lamppost changes, nigger. Change, stop being an instant yes machine. Change, niggers don't change, they just grow. That's a change, bigger and better niggers. Change into a necessary black self. Change like a gas meter gets higher. Change like a blues song getting or talking about a righteous tomorrow. Change like a tax bill getting higher. Change like a good sister getting better. Change like knowing wood will burn. Change, know the real enemy. Change, change, nigger standing, nigger standing on the corner. Thought him was cool, him still standing there. It's winter time, him cool. Change, know the real enemy. Change, him wanted to be a TV star. Him is, 10 o'clock news. Wanted, wanted, nigger stole some lemon and lime popsicles. Thought them were diamonds. Change, nigger, change. No, the real enemy. Change. Is you or is you ain't? Change. Now, now, now. Change for the better. Change. Read a change. Live a change. Read a black poem. Change. Be the real people. Change. Black poems will change. Know the real enemy. Change. Know the real enemy. Change. Change your enemy. Change. Know the real. Change. Know the real enemy. Change. Change. Know the real enemy. The real enemy. The real enemy. Real enemy. Change your the enemies. Change your change your enemy. Change. Change. Change your enemy. Know the real enemy. The world's enemy. Know them. Know them. Know them. Know them. Change. Change your enemy. Change. 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 Change your mind, nigger. Wow. What's your reaction to that one? What's its theme?
It's like overload.
It's like overload. Is it poetry?
Yeah.
I'm sure. But it's so shocking in its unconventional approach, and we are overloaded, and we experience that, and change is driven home, and it's not about, you know, changing your values between, you know, I want diamonds, you know, and he's so stupid that, or he's so after that, diamonds that he steals lemon and lime pop. Is it about that? And who's a nigger? And can a white person be a nigger?
Sure.
And maybe some of you our age can remember the book, The Student, as nigger. Enslaved by
black like me,
or black like me.
Yeah.
Well, that's really unconventional stuff. Now, here's a very conventional poem that also, I think, is about unconventional living. This is who's more conventional than Robert Frost? And this is his poem called "The Woodpile," and the story of this poem, I think you follow it easier if you know what that is that this guy's just out walking in the woods. And first he comes upon a bird, and he wonders about this bird, and then he wonders about why he's wondering about the bird. And then the bird flies over by a woodpile. And this woodpile is stacked very neatly, but it's way out in the middle of the woods where it has no use at all. And apparently, I'll let you decide. Now, who put this there, and why? And what conventional use is there for a woodpile in the middle of the woods? This is conventional poetry, so you don't have to change. You don't have to be shocked out of your seat. Out walking in the frozen swamp one gray day, I paused and said, "I will turn back from here. No, I will go on farther, and we shall see." The hard snow held me, save where now and then 1 foot went through. The view was all in line, straight up and down, of tall, slim trees, too much alike to mark or name a place by, so as to say for certain I was here or somewhere else. I was just far from home. A small bird flew before me. He was careful to put a tree between us when he lighted, and say no word to tell me who he was, who was so foolish as to think what he thought. He thought that I was after him for a feather, the white one in his tail. Like one who takes everything said as personal to himself. Well, one flight out sideways would have undeceived him, and then there was a pile of wood, for which I forgot him and let his little fear carry him off the way I might have gone, without so much as wishing him good night. He went behind it to make his last stand. It was a cord of maple, cut and split and piled and measured, 4 by 4 by 8, and not another like it could I see. No runner tracks in this year's snow looped near it, and it was older sure than this year's cutting, or even last year's or the years before. The wood was gray and the bark warping off it, and the pile somewhat sunken. Clematis had wound strings round and round it like a bundle. What held it, though, on one side was a tree, still growing, and on one a stake and prop, these latter about to fall. I thought that only someone who lived in turning to fresh tasks could so forget his handiwork on which he spent himself, the labor of his axe, and leave it there, far from a useful fireplace, to warm the frozen swamp as best it could with the slow, smokeless burning of decay. Two very different poems to respond to from your guts, if you would. And we have time. What's unconventional in Robert's, in Faust's very conventional poem?
He wonders about the person who put the wood pile there.
And what kind of person was that? We don't know.
I can't imagine.
We can't imagine. Why would anybody do this? Was it hard? I mean, how? Talk about what this person did. What do we know from the poem? I mean, chopped this pile of wood, but...
He's meticulous.
Meticulous, great word for him. 4x4x8, stacked perfectly. Stake driven in, right? Leaned up against the tree, stake driven in, and a prop next to that to hold it. What else do we know? That's a hard one to remember if you don't have it right in front of you. I'll just read that phrase again. Well, I can remember. Who spent, remember, himself, comma, the labor of his axe. Easy? Anybody ever chop wood?
No, it's not.
No, it's not easy. So here's this guy out in the middle of nowhere, chopping this pile of wood, stacking it, and he's going to come get it with his sleigh. No tracks.
See this guy who likes to chop wood and does it for fun, which makes him really unconventional and strange, or something so incredible came upon him that he just forgot about this wood pile and didn't come and get it. So, and I can't even imagine what that exciting thing, whatever it was, that tore away.
Yeah. Well, it might be dead.
I was
what?
Going to say,
dead.
Yeah, maybe something happened to him and he couldn't get back.
Because it's been more than three seasons.
So he's dead.
What they would do if they found all those basements like up the road. I mean, it might have been something that was abandoned, you know.
Yeah. Well, we don't know.
Somebody so meticulous about their wood wouldn't leave it there to decay.
Unless he finds just joy in stacking the wood.
And that's too weird, isn't it? That's just too weird.
I like that
job. You know what? So do I.
Maybe.
I used to build forts in my northern Minnesota town, and then I'd build them, and I'd meticulously put them together. Then I'd get my friends, we'd all jump on it and wreck it.
Maybe it's an allegory about all of the things that we amass.
All the things that what? That we amass?
That
yeah.
We want to have.
Fits? Sure.
Or perfectionists don't keep warm.
Yeah. Well, what kind of thinking are we using as we assess this guy that we wonder about? We've made some assumptions.
Logical.
The what?
Logical.
We're being logical.
Practical.
And we're being practical. This guy's got to be nuts. But we are, this is where art really becomes life. I never did understand that when I was a student, what that sentence kind of, what that meant, you know, I mean art is life. When we experience what the poem is, not what the poem is about, but what the poem is, and we've just experienced, we sit here and we say, this guy is wacko. And we, he's got to be dead. We are thinking in real, conventional, ways and the processes that we use, we can't even step outside of the. I don't either. When I read that poem the first time and every time I read it, I think this guy is wacko. But note what's happened to us as the experiencers, not just the readers or the listeners now, the experiencers of this poem. We've slipped into our conventions to assess the situation, and the more we assess it, the more we have a vision to slip out of those conventional assessments and say anything. Let's speculate wildly. He built it for his girlfriend and he's going to take her out there and propose. Or it wasn't a man at all. Yeah, ooh. Women don't chop wood, right? But you see, the convention, and that's a good one to end with, in the sense that art itself makes us experience our own conventions, not only by seeing other people being unconventional, but by just experiencing our understanding of the art experience. We probably live it out conventionally. And then our vision, I think, is changed. I wonder if we don't sometimes assess the New Testament Jesus that way too. Anybody have anything? It's time to go. You got 2 minutes, but I'm not.
I guess what I think is sometimes when we encounter the unconventional, it's so absurd and so crazy in our own thought process that we put forth a lens of convention to make sense of it.
Sure, yes, great sentence. We put forth our lens to make sense of this unconventional person. And, you know, we bottle them up, we put them away in a hospital, or we kill them. Anybody else?
Well, the one about the fast one, I started laughing during it. And I didn't know why I was laughing, but it was just because it was so true that the pressure I put on myself, I think, to change into this, change into that, try that.
Yeah.
You know, put it all together in some ways. You know, it may work for an hour. I may like myself for an hour. But you know, then you're always going to change into something else.
Yeah.
It was...
That's very insightful. Yeah.
Yeah, it was... it's like, oh, God.
Yeah.
Take it easy.
Yeah, take it. Yeah.
The one I liked, and all, there was some insinuation in the last one there, too, about... The purpose of this pile of wood being to warm the swamp, whatever that was.
Yeah, the last line.
I like that.
It'll warm the swamp with its decay.
I mean, that some kind of design may have... that may have been the real purpose, whatever the purpose it was built for.
Yeah,
You know, whatever. I kind of like that. Whatever reason we do things for, sometimes... they end up serving another purpose far beyond the one that we might have originally created them for.
Yeah. There, I won't read it because it's pretty long. There's a look at it if you're interested. If anybody's ever dealt with grief, there's a wonderful Frost poem called Home Burial. And the story of the poem is there's a woman, and they live in this house out in the country, and their family graveyard is, you can see it through this window. And the woman is at the top of these steps, and there's a window right at the top of those steps also. And she looks out at the window and she can see the graveyard. And she comes down the steps and her husband's at the bottom and they talk. And he has just buried their baby out there in the graveyard. And they have never communicated about his grief nor about hers. And they do there in a painful confrontation on the steps. And it's a 10-minute poem, so that's why I'm not gonna read it. But my point in bringing it up now and why I brought it to this in case there was time is that they're dealing with grief, each of them, in their own conventional ways and can't see past it. And the result is incredible and painful conflict. And she says, I'm leaving. And he said, that's how the poem ends. Don't take it away this time. I'll come back after you. I will. And the poem ends. Because they can't get past this, we're going to make it happen. Well, enjoy Vespers, and tomorrow we're talking about if anybody wants to come, sports and literature.
Thank you.